Can we save our oceans? And can the mermaids help us?
I wanted to be able to find a way to combine stories and statistics and myth and fact to really create a wake-up call to get more people involved in helping to save our oceans.
Can we save our oceans? And can the mermaids help us? That's filmmaker Susan Rockefeller. We talked to her about her film, Mission of Mermaids, A Love Letter to the Ocean. We also talk with children's book author Jason Chin about his acclaimed new book, Island, A Story of the Galapagos. But first, we encore our 2011 interview with Paolo Bacigalupi about Shipbreaker, his dystopian sci-fi novel that takes place in a world altered by climate change. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Climate talks are happening again, this time in Doha, Qatar, a country whose wealth is entirely built on petroleum and which has the highest carbon emissions per capita on the planet. Maybe that's fitting, since once again the talks are being dominated by the flagrant hypocrisy of the globe's major industrialized nations. Led by the U.S., they seem set to do nothing but dither as the planet burns. In recent weeks, even the World Bank has seen fit to warn that we must slash emissions drastically starting now if we are to avert utter catastrophe. It's well to remember, therefore, what our children and their children will be dealing with. Last year, we spoke with science fiction writer Paolo Bacigalupi about his young adult novel, Shipbreaker. It takes place around 2100, the time when the World Bank says we could be seeing the Earth's temperature around 5 degrees centigrade higher than today. Seas will have risen to drown our coastlines, and most people will be scrabbling just to survive. This is the world of Bacigalupi's young protagonist, a boy who works salvaging the wrecks of our world as he comes to age in his. Here's our 2011 interview with author Paolo Bacigalupi. Shipbreaker is a dystopian novel that takes place in the not-too-distant future, and maybe you could enlighten us on when do you envision this time frame?
Honestly, when I write, I try to avoid actually putting a specific date on it. I'm always aware of George Orwell's 1984 being time-stamped with obsolescence, sort of, even as it becomes more relevant.
Yeah.
And so I try to avoid putting dates on anything. I always sort of say this, you know, sort of there's a general sense that it's 100-something years forward. But, you know, I never actually try to nail that down too closely. Because I don't want people to be too distracted about the specific likelihood of this event by this time point, or that event by that time point. But so at some point in the future, it's a story where we've run out of cheap oil and easily available energy, and climate change has had huge impacts where the sea levels have risen and massive hurricanes are striking against the Gulf Coast, and it's focuses on a couple of kids or several kids who work on a shipbreaking operation on the Gulf Coast, tearing apart the old oil tankers and freighters from what they call the accelerated age, which is our age. And they're tearing apart the last pieces of sort of the former industrial petroleum-based society that existed before for all the resources that they can harvest out of it. So
this is a future that's coming on us a much more swiftly than many of us thought. And it's got tremendous verisimilitude. The Gulf Coast, as you say, is very polluted. And also the social structure seems to be one that we're morphing towards with acceleration. Talk a little bit about the kind of society that has inherited this new environment in the world.
Well, to be honest, I really based a lot of what I built into the book is harvested from present-day circumstances around the world. It focuses on a vast gap between rich and poor, where there's a group of people who are massively disenfranchised to a horrific extent and are starving, and that's those kids on the shipbreaking operations. And then there are people who are very wealthy and have a lot of political power, a lot of economic power, and they sit at the top of the food chain. And the gap between rich and poor is, we have that now. We just isolate ourselves from it. We don't smash up against that gap very often. Whether you're talking about, you know, a suburb in, say, Tennessee versus an inner city school in Nashville, you know, those two worlds are right next to each other but don't interact necessarily. And in the same way, the United States doesn't have a whole lot of interaction with the poverty of Bangladesh. And even a closer and more interesting example to me is El Paso has a very different life than Ciudad Juarez right across the border in Mexico, essentially one giant megacity divided by a border and dividing two very, very different kinds of life.
Yeah, and in your book also, there's the same disjuncture between those on the bottom and those that are often just seen from a distant horizon.
Right. For the kids who are on the shipbreaking beaches, tearing apart all these old oil tankers and freighters, they can see another version of life out on the horizon of the Gulf. They can see these new high-technology clipper ships sailing past, and they can see a different kind of life that's out there. These people on these sailing vessels who live a cleaner, easier life than the one that they live, and it's just out of reach for them. And a lot of the story is about them trying to get out to that life.
Yeah. And now, tell us, why are these ships being broken apart?
Resources. It's actually directly based on what happens in the shipbreaking yards of Bangladesh and Chittagong. They're tearing the freighters apart for the iron, the steel, the copper, everything that can be recycled. And what you see today in present-day shipbreaking operations is that resource-poor places like Bangladesh can accept in essentially our deceased tankers, our deceased freighters, our deceased ocean liners, and they can tear those apart, and that actually contributes a significant amount of raw materials to their economy. And so what we think of as recycling, it really looks a lot more like mining. They mine these ships for resources and then turn that into value at the other end. And so I'm really interested in that idea that when resources are scarce, that a lot of the things that we in the industrial West sort of take for granted and throw away, that waste resource is actually of huge value. And so the assumption is that in the future, as resources become depleted, we're going to look again at our waste stream and think about those things in a different way and want to try to harvest the value out of them. Of course, tearing apart something like an oil tanker or ripping apart computers or whatever kind of recycling operation you talk about is a pretty dirty, dangerous, toxic process. And so the people who are going to do that are not going to be the people who benefit from it. And so you're going to put the poorest and the most disenfranchised people to work tearing apart all of our junk to get the resource out.
And the children, because they have to be small to get into the smallest spaces.
Right, yeah. In Shipbreaker, I talk a lot about these kids who work on something called the light crew, which is the kids who go in and they tear out all the small fittings, all the wiring, everything that can be ripped out before the heavy crews come in and start actually carving up the ship. And so the kids have to be small in order to fit into small spaces, to crawl through ducts, to do all of this different stuff. And when they get too big, then they get kicked off their job. And a few of them, you know, might have a hope of getting into the heavy crews later on, but a lot of them are simply discarded when they're no longer of use, when they get too big.
And you have now the title...
Because that's the kind of happy story I write.
Yeah, the happy story. You know, when we were talking before we formally started this interview, you said this was your, I forget the term you used, but this was like your light book, happy book.
Oh, yeah, no, this is my light and fluffy stuff, absolutely. Hmm. The other stuff that I write for adults, actually, the stuff I write tends to be much, much more grim. And it's not so much that the setting is not grim. I tend to focus on these mangled futures. I tend to be interested in the idea of what happens after the prosperity ends. Mm-hmm. Once the party's over, what does the world look like? And that's sort of a common theme through a lot of what I work with. But with kids' books, when I'm writing for young people, I do feel a little more comfortable writing stories that at least have a positive through line in them. And so the story that Naylor follows, the kid on the shipbreaking crew who's trying to find his way into a better life, he's going to have a sense of possibility and hope as he sort of makes his way through his very brutal world that I don't normally allow for my adult characters in my adult novels, because honestly, I don't really feel like adults really deserve a sense of hope. I think they sort of deserve a slap in the face, whereas kids, because they're still developing their futures and they're still making decisions about what kind of future they're going to build as they come of age, I'm more comfortable sort of identifying paths to success for them that I might not be comfortable identifying for adults, where I just sort of feel like adults need a smack.
So you want to slap the grown-ups upside the head here. And in this book, Shipbreaker, Paolo Bacigalupi, the grown-ups really have failed the children. I mean, even within this society, not to speak of in the actual real society in which we live, the
right.
grown-ups have failed the children. I mean, what's gone on? Why has this happened?
Okay, there's a bunch of things that were going on for me when I wrote this book, actually. And I originally started writing this book thinking that I wanted to write about certain sustainability questions, about certain environmental questions, things like that. What ended up happening as I was working through the book was that it ended up also focusing a lot about what's a family structure, what makes a family, and what kinds of support networks do we depend on outside of family, and how, and a lot of it has to do with trust relationships, and a lot of it has to do with how we define those trust relationships. And so there's a character in the book, Naylor's father, who is a terrible human being, both drug addicted and violent. And part of the story became a query about exactly how much do you owe your family, and what is the value of family ties exactly. That ends up connecting for me in a lot of other ways to questions about adults failing children, because in a lot of ways I actually feel like the whole purpose of Shipbreaker is really to give young people a chance to experience the society that we as adults are handing off to our children. We hand them off a society that has fewer resources, that has fewer options, and has more challenges than the one that we inherited from our parents. And that's a generational failure. And so I'm interested in that from a couple of different levels, both inside of the traditional family structure, like what is a generational failure, and then in this larger sense of like, what do we as a society hand off to our children? And both of those things ended up being really interesting to me.
I asked Paolo Bacigalupi what kind of feedback he'd gotten from his readers about the world he portrays in his books.
I would say that there's a segment of my readers who seem to understand that the world is built to describe specific things and to cause a certain reflection back to our own world, to look around at ourselves in our own world and ask some questions. I'd say there's another segment of my readers who simply read it as thrill ride. And that's kind of interesting, too. It says a lot about us.
Say more about that.
I think that without being incredibly judgmental, I think that we're quite dedicated to keeping blinders on about the kind of world that we're building for the future. And we've created a society now which is entertainment and, what would you call it, there's a science fictional term, eyeball kick oriented, I guess. People are looking for the next thrill. They aren't necessarily looking for more thought. And so as long as it's thrilling, they like it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're thinking about it. And it's something that I sort of have wondered about, whether or not Shipbreaker in some ways misfires, if it's still too much fun for people to actually think. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the perfect balance of those things is. When I write adult fiction, I've had people sort of accuse me of essentially writing grimness for grimness's sake, that's all I'm about, which isn't really, and you don't want to be perceived that way. You want to be perceived as having something to say that's relevant, as opposed to simply being, I don't know, Chicken Little worrying about the sky falling. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff there that I'm still sort of parsing through as I sort of see how each story goes out into the world and then what kind of response comes back. But it does sort of concern me when somebody says, hey, that was really cool and fun. And you're thinking, yeah, so did you get anything more out of Shipbreaker other than that? Or was it just really cool and fun? And I don't know. I mean, and you know, for each reader, their mileage will vary as well. So
what you're talking about is very similar in some ways to the debate that goes on within the community of those of us, I include myself, who write about sustainability and climate and the environment, and that is, do you bum people out by telling them exactly really what's going on?
Right, exactly.
Or do you kind of entice them in by giving them lollipop visions of, you know, the wonderful green future?
Right, exactly. And that question of carrot and stick, that question of, like, what if you bum people out so much that they don't care, or they stop listening, that they deliberately bring down the blinders? I think that there's, in some ways, I think that we have an illusion when we're talking about sustainability that by keeping the conversation going, we're actually doing anything at all. You know, people are going to put down their blinders. They put down their blinders by saying, oh, I can passively be fine, it's all good, you know. Or they put down their blinders saying, I don't want to hear you, I don't like what you're saying. But the behavior set, the actual behavior outcome seems roughly similar. You don't actually have a shift in behavior that moves towards sustainability. You either have people feeling good about themselves and doing nothing, or they're annoyed at you, but they're still doing nothing. And either way, you know, we don't change. And so given a choice between those two things, I'd rather speak truth. And I'd rather speak truth unvarnished. And that's kind of where I'm starting to feel more and more, is that people don't like hearing truth spoken baldly. And then you have certain, it's interesting, as a writer, you have certain question marks in your mind about, you know, if you want to continue to pay the bills, how baldly do you speak truth? But I'm not sure that it speaks well of us when we candy coat what's going on, and I'm not sure that it speaks well of our audiences that they have so little tolerance for actually engaging with almost anything that's really going on in the world around them. And I count myself among those people. I mean, there are certainly times where I see a headline and I think, okay, now that I know that piece about the meatpacking industry or whatever, I think I can stop right there at the headline. I don't need to read the entire story, you know. And so I understand the very human urge to flinch away from information that's unpalatable or might force me to reevaluate my world, you know, and I recognize that. I'm just not sure what the clever way to slide past that is. Shipbreaker was an attempt to do that in some ways, and in some ways I feel like it succeeded too well, that it was too much fun. And, you know, then you're also sort of inside of the head of the crazy writer obsessing about all these things that I really can't control anyway.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with sci-fi writer Paolo Bacigalupi about his terrific young adult novel, Shipbreaker. It's about a young man living in a world of rising seas and scarce resources who must test his mettle against those who would destroy him. You're also writing in this book, I mean, although it's a book that's great to read for anyone of any age, but you're writing for young people who might be more open to the reality. I mean, I think, you know, back when I was a young adult, as they call it, when I was an adolescent and I was reading books about the future, I mean, my hunger was for a new vision.
Right.
And it had tremendous impact. I mean, when I read The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, it made me really think very deeply about gender. Mm-hmm. When I read Woman on the Edge of Time, I mean, my God, that book by Marge Piercy had a great impact on me throughout my life. I mean, even today, there are times that I think about that future. And
right.
I look at the future, I look at the world we're living now, and I'm wondering, will there be pockets where people can create a new vision, or are we just going to be the dystopian vision?
Right, and I that's interesting. I got like three thoughts on that, and now I'm going to forget them all. But the first thought was that there are really very interesting pockets all around us, and that those idea sparks seem like if they're, you know, given enough oxygen and they're given enough support, that they really could spread. And one of the things that, you know, as a science fiction writer, you're always sort of looking around at these little pieces of data and trying to say, well, does this actually, is this going to be the telling storyline? Is this piece of information about how we can harness wind power? Or is this piece of information about how, you know, how we can make a better, you know, essentially a better kitchen fire in India? Is there something here that's telling me important information about the future, and how do I evaluate it against, you know, ExxonMobil's latest profit report? And which of these storylines is actually dominant? And so there are some questions always going on about, like, do we understand the dominant storylines, the defining storylines, or do we not? Which is really fascinating to me. And that was actually something, so the reason originally why I decided to write young adult fiction was there is a certain, I have a certain obsession with a being of use to the world. You sort of want to have some reason to think that your existence actually is worthwhile. And I realized that when I was writing fiction for adults, that you could have adults who would nod their heads and agree with what you were writing and think that what you were writing was important, but they fundamentally would not change. And not through any core faults of their own, but just because they have mortgages and they have jobs and they have this much of an investment in existing infrastructure. So their life is fixed. And so, you know, the metaphor that I've used before is to think about adults as being essentially trains on train tracks. And they're already late. They've left the station and they're rolling down the tracks. And it's very hard for an adult to get off those train tracks and, you know, sort of hump their way across the desert like a caterpillar to some other set of train tracks that goes in a better, more sustainable direction. It takes a lot of effort. And even if you're going towards a cliff, it still takes a lot of effort to get off those train tracks. Whereas when I think about young people, I think about them as being sort of trains that haven't left the station yet. They're still acquiring their skills. They're still acquiring their values. They're still acquiring their educations, making decisions about what kind of people they're going to be, what kinds of professions they're going to follow, and also, you know, what kind of infrastructure they're going to build around themselves. You know, where are they going to buy their house? Is it going to be one in the suburbs, or is it going to be one in the city? Is it going to be on a farm? Is it going to be, you know, they've got these decisions that they can make. And so it seems worthwhile to have a conversation with people who haven't, you know, already set their lives in stone. And that is something that's really positive to me and is really interesting to me about that moment when we're young and we actually also want to do things that matter, and we also do want to have a positive impact on our world, and we haven't sort of succumbed to inertia and cynicism and all these things that we think of as more sort of adult values of, well, we all know you can't change the world. There was a whole line inside of Shipbreaker that I was really interested in, which is talking about technologies that I think are interesting and trying to make those really cool. And one of those in particular was wind power. And I wanted to talk about wind in a way that made it seem interesting and fun and exciting and fabulous. And that was where the clipper ships that sort of succeed our petroleum economy came from. And those clipper ships, these beautiful sailing ships with high altitude parasails and hydrofoils, you know, they're very high tech, and, you know, they're sexy tech cool. And part of that was that I was thinking, science fiction is really interesting to me because science fiction has had a long tradition of inspiring engineers. You know, a science fiction writer writes about something that's interesting, and then engineers get interested enough in it that they say, hey, well, what if I wanted to build that for real? And you see that with, you know, NASA scientists who grew up reading about rocket ships and then went on to work on rocket ships. And you see that with things like the video game Second Life, which is based off of Neal Stephenson's metaverse in the novel Snow Crash. You know, the engineering types saw the idea and found it so fascinating that they wanted to replicate it in reality. And so there's a part of me that very much hopes that if you make a technology like wind, or I mean an energy source like wind, interesting enough, that you'll inspire a generation of people to think, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had those? And to sort of push in that direction. And that for me is the, you know, as close as I can come to a carrot idea. It's not that the thing exists now, but wouldn't it be cool if?
It's making the possible real in the imagination, which is,
right,
in fact, the way things happen.
Yes. And that's a really powerful concept, and it's really powerful, you know, that in fiction, you can describe these things. You know, I think it's the moment where I have a friend who's a science journalist. She writes a lot about the environment. She can't write about what isn't there. And that's the thing that's so powerful about fiction, and specifically about science fiction, is that ability to write about what might be there.
And I'm talking with Paolo Gattigalupi.
Paolo. I know it's a terrible name.
No, it's a beautiful name. It's a beautiful name. Paolo Gattigalupi, about his terrific novel, Shipbreaker. So, and you're saying, you know, you're saying, well, in a way that this is light, but really the positive vision is as powerful an element to this story as the negative one.
Right.
Is what I'm hearing from you.
I wanted to have those balanced things. The idea of here's the world that we're handing off to our young people, which is broken, fundamentally broken. It's resource depleted, and it's damaged, and it's hard. But also, here's a window into something better. And that, you know, if you can sort of pass through the keyhole, there is something on the other side that's more worthwhile. And that is, you know, sustainable technologies. That is these beautiful clipper ships. It is that life on the ocean sailing. And yeah, it's the contrast between those two things that I think it certainly gives me the tingle every time I describe it, which is sort of interesting. I'm like, huh, there's something powerful in the description of that idea of passing through to a better world,
and yet a world in this book in which very few people have access to that technology.
Right.
So that brings up another question. You know, you wrote this book before the youth revolution in Egypt and Tunisia, and of course they're in a very troubled place because the old order has really not given up yet. But what lessons do you take, if any, from that, in the sense that these are very much fueled by a youth who want a different future?
You know, it's interesting. I think I think that, you know, revolutions are traditionally started by the young. Mao Zedong didn't decide to become a revolutionary when he was 50. And so, you know, this process of overthrowing governments and creating major social change, it's a young person's pursuit. Honestly, the lesson that I really take from a lot of these is that I look at the governments that fell and the governments that haven't, and what I see is, those governments that are serious about maintaining power do a much better job of it. And you see it in Iran, you see it in Libya, and they make their citizens bleed for every step that they take. And it's interesting to see that because, you know, when you see the first couple of governments topple, you think, oh, this is something that's, it strikes me as less of the power of the youth and more the weakness of the state.
Right.
That's, you know, sort of my off the cuff sort of thinking about it, but it's just, it strikes me that, you know, that in places like Iran, where they actually have a solid, you know, control over their military and also a solid ideological base, competing youth ideological base, that there's a much stronger chance of pushing down sort of what then becomes a somewhat isolated minority of students in the larger nation, as opposed to someplace like Egypt, where there wasn't a strong control over the ideology of the state, and so it failed, and so the state failed.
Paolo Gattigalupi thinks technological change alone can't solve our environmental problems.
I honestly think that we can't techno-fix ourselves out of our sustainability questions. I think that you either have to rejigger the way that we structure our economies and the way that we think about money and capital and value. And so there's a huge social change there where we sort of came to this point where we said capitalism triumphant and free markets triumphant, and this is the lesson that we bring from the defeat of the Soviet Union. And I think that you're talking about really needing to rejigger the way that we structure our economies so that we don't perceive our natural capital as being an income stream. I've become really obsessed with economics lately. Both of the stories that I'm working on right now have a lot to do with economics. And I think that if you don't have that social hack that either reins in the power of corporate ownership or reins in the ability or the illusion that we can grow indefinitely, that reins in the idea that profit is an always escalating thing, and that it's an abstraction, that profit is abstracted from the natural resources that actually create that profit, I think that we're in somewhat in trouble. I mean, the off-the-cuff sort of example of that is something like Apple Computer, which is doing really, really well right now, but they have a massive incentive to sell more and more iPads. That's what they have to do in order to be a viable company. And as long as their profit incentive focuses solely on the process of extracting more resources and selling and then reselling to consumers, you're looking at a society that isn't working, even as it's fabulously designed.
Paolo Bacigalupi. We talked to him about his novel Shipbreaker in April of 2011. Next up, filmmaker Susan Rockefeller tells us about mermaids and saving the oceans. Stay tuned after the break.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent. La mer des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Filmmaker Susan Rockefeller lives part of the time in Bridgehampton, New York, on the east end of Long Island. The sea is in her blood and in her bones, but it wasn't until she read an article by Elizabeth Culbert called The Darkening Sea that she decided to create a cinematographic love letter to the ocean. Culbert's article is about how the carbon emissions we're spewing into the atmosphere are making the oceans more acidic. That means many marine animals, like shellfish, won't be able to survive. That's a huge hole being blown into the web of life on which we depend. But Rockefeller's short film isn't doom and gloom. Instead, it explores the myth, meaning, and science of the oceans and reminds us of our deep connection to them. Susan Rockefeller, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Your film Mission of Mermaids is a love letter to the ocean. That's its subtitle. What got you involved in doing this project?
Well, I have been coming out to the beach since I was about 3 years old. Love the beaches of Long Island, East Hampton. And I've always had a love relationship. It's a place I go for peace and solace and creativity. It's where many of my favorite memories are and continue to be. And I love it. I love to dive into the ocean waves. I like to paddleboard. I like to sail. I like to swim. I'm a great swimmer. I love to swim. So I came to my concern about oceans, one, because I love the ocean. I love the beauty of the ocean, but what really turned the tide for me, literally and figuratively, was reading an article in The New Yorker that Elizabeth Culbert had written called The Darkening Sea. And it was an article about the effects of carbon dioxide on our oceans and ocean acidification. So a couple years ago, I co-produced a film called A Sea Change with Barbara Ettinger and Sven Husaby. It was a feature documentary, and it looked at what was happening to the state of our oceans. And what I decided after working on that film was that we really needed to get many more people into the conversation and into the activism around ocean issues. And I wanted to find a way to get beyond the pure science and really ignite people's hearts and minds. And I looked at the myth of the mermaid, and I thought that as a child, people dream about mermaids, and they are present in almost every culture, whether it's the Selkie or the siren or the mermaid. It's very popular in all different books and popular culture, films. logos like Starbucks. I mean, it's everywhere. Once you start thinking about the mermaid, you see them everywhere. So I wanted to be able to find a way to combine stories and statistics and myth and fact to really create a wake-up call to get more people involved in helping to save our oceans.
It's a very haunting film. And of course, a mermaid is a female figure. Talk about the idea of the mermaid as a feminine figure, as symbolic of the ocean, which I think that's very much a metaphor for the ocean that you use here.
Yes, it is. That's a great question. I did a lot of reading about the mermaid, and I did a lot of research on the myth of the mermaid. And in the conventional myths, what happens, as many of us know, a man falls in love with a mermaid and she loses her tail and goes to land and gets married and has a couple of children. But all she asks for is uninterrupted time to herself, where she can return to that sacred place, which is the water. And in many of the stories, the husband gets jealous, spies on her, and their love is lost forever, and she returns to the ocean. So the whole idea is the need for women, and I also say it's mermaids, it's mermen, it's merfolk, it's merteen, it's everybody. It's the idea that we all need sacred time, we all need time to rest, and if we give ourselves that time to rest, we can give back with more renewed energy to our loved ones and to the work and to the things that we want to do. And I take that analogy and say, like the mermaid, the ocean needs time to rest. And if we just give it time to rest, it can rebound. And it's similar to in agriculture, we let a field lay fallow. It's the same idea. So it's really taking that. And I think everybody can understand that when we take those mermaid moments or those times where we just give ourselves permission to rest, we come back a healthier, more revitalized person. And it's the same with the ocean. So I'm on the board of Oceana, which is a global nonprofit organization solely focused on ocean protection. And it's very much the messaging that we need to give the ocean time to rest. We need to enforce fishing regulations. We need to minimize bycatch, and we need to protect fish habitat, and the oceans can come back.
We've talked on this show with Carl Safina of the Blue Ocean Institute about his book, The View from Lazy Point. And he makes a point that you also make in the book, which is that we're just emptying the sea out. I think in your film you say we've eaten more than 90% already of the big fish in the sea. I also have had conversations with fishermen around here who are just up in arms, outraged, you know, talking with their representatives, Kristen Gillibrand here, about, you know, the shocking shame of not being able to do their catches as much as they want. Could you weigh in on this controversy? You know, these are small fishermen, and they see their livelihood being affected.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a great book. I think Carl Safina is fantastic. I've actually fished out in Montauk with him. I think he's a brilliant voice for ocean conservation. There's a great book called The Life of the Lobster, and it talks about working with local lobstermen. This is in the case of New England and Maine, and scientists to come up with quotas and ways of managing that particular fishery. And I think that what people need to understand is that if you want to have a sustainable number of fish and fish resources for generations to come, we need to just enforce existing regulations. And the problem is that there has been so much overfishing and the resources are depleted. And fishermen can be complaining, and I understand that, but it's the fact is that we should be getting every local person educated to talk to congressmen and make sure that they make sure that laws are enforced so that we can bring the population of fish back to where it once was. And we do have, there is hope. I mean, people are saying that in the next 20 years, we can reverse the tide of ocean destruction, but we have to start now.
Well, you've talked about a couple of things here. There's overfishing. There's also CO2, carbon dioxide pollution, the ocean acidification. We're reading in the papers of the collapse of the Great Barrier Reef and the coral in the ocean. Also in your film, Susan Rockefeller, in your film Mission of Mermaids, You also talk about plastic pollution in the ocean and PCBs and mercury. Give us just a quick little primer on all these assaults, and then I'll ask you about hope.
Well, what's interesting is I think people can get their minds around plastic pollution, and there's a lot of work being done on refusing single-use plastic. So you normally have reduce, reuse, recycle, and now there's this fourth R, which is refuse single-use plastic, because so much of our plastic ends up in the waste stream and into our oceans. So there's pollution, which is a very hard, it's hard to solve the pollution issue because you've got so much drainage issues, you've got chemicals, you've got fertilizers that, you know, literally go from the land to the sea. In terms of the biggest threats to our oceans, it's really the overfishing. So, you know, I would say the most important thing people can do is support an organization like Oceana, which is working on enforcing fishing regulations, because you can actually make a difference and we can solve the ocean issue. I know that's a little bit moving toward hope, but I do think that it's such a complicated, if you think about it, the ocean is 70% of our planet, and yes, and less than 2% of conservation dollars go to ocean conservation. So people need to understand it's vast. It's there. I think a lot of people look at the surface and they see this beautiful ocean with the glistening sun on the surface, and they don't realize that there is a lot going on beneath the surface. And I think obviously you mentioned the PCBs and plastic pollution, and I think that there's a real need to get people to become more activated to understand that there's also a fish resource that over a billion people rely on for their main source of protein.
In fact, in the film, you suggest responsible fish farming. Is that a contradiction in terms?
Well, I think it is not a contradiction in terms. Fish farming, there's different ways that you can look at aquaculture. 50% of our fish is now aquaculturally raised. You need to look at what fish you want to raise. So for instance, salmon takes 3 pounds of protein for 1 pound of salmon. So you're essentially creating a new customer for wild fish by creating these salmon farms. So if you look at any kind of, you know, mussels or oysters or tilapia that is either a filtering system or vegetation-based, that's something that is sustainable and that we should look toward. But fish farming is our future, and it's here now, and it's here to stay. Mm. It's just how we balance that with the wild protein that they're using to feed certain aquaculturally raised fish.
So they're actually catching wild fish to feed to farmed fish?
A lot of sardines, yes. So essentially the best thing that one can do is eat lower on the food chain and not eat the big fish. That, you know, 90% of the really big fish, the marlins, the tuna, the swordfish, they're gone. And they also, from a health standpoint, you know, the FDA has said that women of childbearing age and children should have 6 ounces of tuna or swordfish a week. That's comparable to like one sandwich, right? So the mercury in the seafood is a neurotoxin and can affect fetal development and memory. There's a lot of reasons why you don't want to be ingesting a huge quantity of tuna. So eating lower on the food chain is one way. If you choose to eat fish, that's one way to get the protein and not be depleting our oceans.
We're talking with filmmaker Susan Rockefeller about her film Mission of Mermaids, A Love Letter to the Ocean. The film is not just a film about the facts. It's really a film that's quite beautiful and features a lot of mermaids who look pretty realistic. I'm just wondering, how did you get that effect? You have women who are, you know, flapping their tails, mermaids who are flapping their tails through the ocean. How did you do this?
Well, what's amazing to me is the amount of mermaid activists that are all over the world. So you've got Save the Mermaids in California. You've got Hannah Fraser, who is a fantastic mermaid activist. You've got Linda Wolbert. You've got all these wonderful women that are taking their tail and they are using that as a metaphor. So I think it's really inspiring. I think that to me, the mermaid represents all the mystery that's in the ocean. We have over a million species that are yet to be identified. There's so much mystery and magic in the ocean. I think so many people that go to the ocean and go to the beach and they, you know, they look and they see beautiful shells and they see the glistening of the sand, and it just, it opens you up to imagination. And I think that what will solve so many of our environmental problems, and they are so complex, is to engage people's hearts and imagination. And my hope with this film, because it is a love letter, is that if you love something, you will do your best to save it. And I want as many people to learn about the beauty and the mystery of our oceans, engage in the ocean, whether it's recreationally or just as a place that you go for calm, but also to understand that there's so much at stake in terms of world and human suffering if we don't, from a food security standpoint, preserve what's left and help to revitalize what's there now.
I can't imagine a world with an ocean, with oceans that are not alive.
Well, to imagine a world with no fish is devastating. So my hope is that people will see this film and they will hopefully join a group like Oceana. We have over 500,000 Wavemaker activists online. So we want to create a movement. We want to get people engaged and educated and inspired and activated to become mermaid ambassadors or ocean activists, however you want to put it. But the idea is that people have to love it. They want to, you have to love it to want to save it. And that's what I found time and time again. You can talk yourself blue in the face about ocean facts and what's going on, but if you don't engage people and get them inspired or interested, you're not going to really create any change.
As a board member of Oceana, what are some of the major campaigns you're working on right now, or pick one?
I'll pick one because I think I did talk about, you know, the importance of protecting the ocean to feed the world. And that is one of our campaigns through enforcing fishing regulations and what I spoke about earlier. But one that I think really connects to what we were talking about in terms of healthy eating and mercury in seafood is also fish fraud and seafood fraud. And we have a campaign, it's a seafood fraud campaign. They're finding that one out of three fish are mislabeled. So you think you're getting a grouper or a sea bass and you're getting a tilapia. So Oceana is involved in a traceability initiative. And what I find so unbelievable is that you think you're getting a wild salmon. You know, you get a wild salmon, they flash freeze it, they send it to Asia, they defrost it, they fillet it, they freeze it again. There are all these different steps in the process before it gets to you to eat. And who's managing and monitoring? We have an FDA that monitors a lot of our food, but we do not have somewhat an agency that's really monitoring the traceability of fish. So Oceana is very involved in a seafood fraud campaign that will be, you know, vital to consumer health and for us better understanding where our fish comes from. And that in turn will help many of the local, you know, because you asked about the fishermen here, if you can trace it to a local sustainable fishing practice, and then people can start buying fish based on, you know, where it was caught, how it was caught, and be part of the solution.
Yeah, because it sounds like if it's not sustainable, you could buy a locally wild-caught fish and it could go to China and then back to the United States. I mean, the food miles, the carbon emissions just involved in that, you know, will just add to the ocean's burden.
Exactly. It adds to the carbon and the ocean acidification. It's all interconnected. So I would say the most important thing is if you're eating fish is to really find local, get to know your fishermen, find out what their stories, find out about, you know, how they fish and why they fish and where they fish, and start learning about the place where you live and have a sense of both the land and the sea and how it can sustain us.
I asked Susan Rockefeller how listeners can find out more about her film and where it's being shown.
So if you go to susanrockefeller.com or to missionofmermaids.com, both are websites, they have information. They have the trailer on the film. They have all the upcoming screenings. The great news is that the Santa Fe Institute along with Sydney Davis, who is an Oceana board member, have put together curriculum. So the film will be available for classroom use for 5th to 8th graders soon, coming soon. So get on the website, go check out SusanRockefeller.com, and you can get information and ask any questions and get involved in what we also have something called Circle of Mermaids. So if you're involved in beach cleanups or you want to send us a photograph of your favorite beach, we have an online community that we're building as well.
And finally, is there really hope?
There is hope. I think that, you know, a lot of people ask me that question. They say, I'm so overwhelmed. The enormity of these problems are so complex. I just want to crawl into a hole. How do you do it? And what I say to people is that you can start small. You can join a local Save the Bay group or a waterkeeper, riverkeeper group. You can join Oceana. And by joining a group, you are linking arms, maybe tails. But you're joining a community and you don't feel like you're alone. And then I think from just a pure personal standpoint, you can refuse single-use plastic. You can buy sustainable seafood. You could go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium and find out what fish is healthy for you, what fish is sustainable. So there's lots of ways you can vote responsibly. You know, you can get involved and feel like you're making a difference because if each of us, one voice, I always say a small ripple can make big waves, and we all need to be part of the solution. And the ocean gives us half the air we breathe, and it's the most incredibly dynamic part of in so many ways, it's so dynamic and so beautiful. And we need to treasure it because it's what gives us our health.
We can't live without it. Well, Susan Rockefeller, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your film is Mission of Mermaids, A Love Letter to the Ocean. It's really a beautiful film, and I encourage all of our listeners to view it, to find out where it's being shown, and to join this vital struggle to save the oceans.
Thank you so much.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the film's website and to see the trailer. You'll also find a link to Elizabeth Colbert's article that inspired Susan Rockefeller to make her film. And finally, grown-ups who are looking for a book to give a young person this holiday season need go no further than author and illustrator Jason Chin. He's a master at telling stories about the natural environment. His books, Redwoods and Coral Reefs, combined gorgeous illustrations with sophisticated science expressed in simple and engaging language. His new book, Island, does no less. His protagonist is one of the islands formed by a volcanic eruption millions of years ago in the Galapagos. Chin tells the story of its birth, growth, adulthood, and old age, and along the way explains the science of evolution and introduces the reader to a multitude of creatures of the land, sea, and air. The book can be enjoyed by people of all ages, including kids from kindergarten through the middle grades. I wanted to just read the very first page, and this is the chapter Birth, 6 million years ago. You write, "The sun is rising over a lonely group of islands more than 600 miles away from the nearest continent. The air is still and the sea is calm, but beneath the water, something is stirring." It's a lovely mixture of both science and imagination, which I think becomes clear just in reading that you bring the reader right into that place. Now, you actually set out to write a book about evolution. Why did you choose writing about these islands?
Yeah, it's an interesting how this book came together, I guess. I had been reading a lot about evolution. So my two books prior to this, I wrote one about redwoods and one about coral reefs. And while I was researching those books, I also read a bunch of several books about evolution, about Darwin, and I had in my mind that I'd like to do a book about evolution, but I didn't really have a good idea for how to make that topic into a good book. And then separately, I I had known about this, you know, volcanic island formation from some other. And so one day I had this idea, what if I told the story of an island and made the island itself the main character in the book? So that was the actual initial idea for the book. And then, you know, a few days later, I put two and two together, like, hey, I could do the Galapagos Islands and work in some stuff about evolution into this story. So, with all my books, I do nonfiction books, but I always try and make the book a good story. You know, to me, that's the most important thing.
You know, you've written three books now. There's Coral Reefs and Redwoods. And Redwoods won some prizes as well. Why have you chosen to focus on science in your work as an illustrator and writer of children's books?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I've tried to write storybooks, fictional picture books, and, you know, it hasn't worked out for me, to be honest. And when I wrote Redwoods, was my first first book that I wrote, it just came out very naturally. It was just a good fit for me as an artist. It was easy for me to write it, to get excited about it, and ultimately to create the book. Also, science specifically is something I'm just really interested in.
I asked Jason Chin if he had any challenges in presenting the science, which is pretty sophisticated, in such a clear way that anyone could understand, even younger children. He said that ever since his first book, Redwoods, he's been encouraged not to soft pedal the science.
The response to that book was really good, and when I presented in schools, I had teachers constantly telling me, you know, whatever you do on your next book, don't take out the science. Keep this reading level high. And I think what they were responding to was that book is very accessible to younger kids, even though the language is at a high reading level. Someone in California, I think there's some state system for ranking the reading level of books. When I was there, they told me that it was ranked at a high school senior level or something like that.
Wow.
Because there are some, you know, there are scientific terms in there that most adults, I mean, I didn't know before I did the research, and most adults don't know or wouldn't recognize. But the books were accessible to young kids. I read them to kindergartners, and they were into it. You know, I've had second graders telling me about coral polyps, and, you know, I had third graders learning about endemic species, and, you know, it's really amazing to see kids grasp these concepts and learn these words that are usually taught to much older kids.
You have, for some of your other books, for Redwoods, you have some reading guide or questions that are available on the web. Are you going to do the same thing for Island, the story of the Galapagos?
Yes. Yeah, right now I'm revamping the educational part of my website. So I hope to have reading guides for all my books and activities for teachers to download if they want to use the books in their classroom. I know a lot of teachers have used these books in their classrooms, and I want to make it easy for more teachers to do so.
Well, the book is Island, the Story of the Galapagos. We've been talking with the author and illustrator, Jason Chin. Thanks so much for talking with us about this gorgeous book.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Author and illustrator, Jason Chin. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his website and to see an illustration from Island. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.